Hello and welcome to this week's episode of the Data Protection Made Easy podcast with me, Jasmine Harrison, and I'm joined by Phil Brining, who's returning, and Joe Kirk. Hi, both of you.
Good afternoon.
Hello.
This was a GDPR radio session and probably my favourite one to date, to be honest. There was so much conversation that all, you know, it connected, but it was really broad at the same time. From Clearview AI made a reappearance because we're still trying to wrap our heads around that, to facial recognition, to subject access requests, to all sorts, the ICO, there was a lot on that. How did you find it?
I liked it. I enjoyed it. I mean,
I've been out. It's good to have you back.
Yeah. Never thought I'd hear you say that, but I've been out for a couple of weeks.
I feel like you really, Phil.
Doing bits and pieces. So I felt a little bit off the pace, but there was quite a bit in the news, wasn't there? What with the King's speech and the digital information bill was mentioned in that. And then there was these AI summits. We talked about that. And, you know, there's quite a lot of interaction, fantastic interaction about facial recognition and the police. And then there's quite a lot to talk about the ICO. We covered a lot of ground, and I thought it was a good. I mean, there's lots of stuff we didn't talk about. I wanted to talk about. We just ran out of time.
It's always the way. How did you find it, Joe?
I thought it was a great session as well. I can't remember who it was that jumped on, but the insight of the facial recognition was really good, actually, because we were kind of at a bit of a lost cause, weren't we, trying to work out how it actually worked. And it came on and gave a bit of background about, you know, what happens when individuals get arrested and it's updated to a database, which obviously then matches to people that are scanned at things such as the Beyonce concert that happened in Cardiff earlier this year. So I thought that was really good. And then, like you say, we touched on the King's speech because the DPDI bill, no number two anymore, has been renamed just to make things confusing. We anticipate that that's going to probably try and get that over the line, although there's a deadline, isn't there, of a general election in 28th of January 2025. So it's got just over a year to get through the final stages of Houses of Commons and then all stages of the Houses of Lords before attaining royal assent. So still a long way to go.
Yeah, well, they can push things through quickly if there's a will. It just depends how it fits in with everything else that's trying to get done.
Yeah, well, the other one, the Bill 2's took a bit of time, hasn't it? So maybe it'll get fast-tracked forward in 2024.
It seems to be I don't know, I have a feeling that it will be, to be honest. But, you know, we'll see. I kind of hope not.
Me too.
Well, it'll be all change if it is, or bits and lots of change.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we've covered a lot on the session, but one thing that I found really useful for people, because we complain about this all the time, was that the ICO's consultation on fines closes in just over a fortnight. So if you've got any opinions on their approach to fines and what they could do to improve and whatnot, then go to the website.
27th of November.
Yeah, 27th of November is the deadline. So get over to the site. But without going into too much, giving away too much in this intro, we'll let you get into the main part of the session, and I hope you enjoy it.
Just, yeah.
Funnily enough, I had an interesting call this morning. A customer of mine, one of my accounts, she called me about a potential breach. So we were unpicking that a little bit. And I think it's reportable to the ICO, so it's not really a happy Friday for her. It was about, so they're a housing association, and they have an ex-employee who's friends with a current tenant, and the ex-employee was worried about the tenant, so they asked the housing association to contact the tenant and you know, see if they could help and what's what. This, you know, they provided support to the tenant, and you know, their situation was progressed. Then the ex-employee asked an employee of the housing association for an update to see if everything went okay. In the first instance, they was like, yeah, she's getting the support she needs. And then they disclosed further information saying that they're providing support around domestic abuse victims. And at this point, at this moment in time, the husband or boyfriend had been arrested, but since then he was released. And the ex-employee went to the tenant and said, I don't know, they had some sort of conversation about this. And the tenant was like, well, I've never told you this. She's obviously retracted what she initially said because he's been released. You know how that can happen in domestic abuse cases. She's like, I never told you this, so I don't know where you've got this information from. And she's, you know, it's come to light that it was disclosed by an employee. So obviously it's confidential. It shouldn't be disclosed.
Yeah,
to the employee.
No, that's not good, is it?
Not at all. No. Joe, you look like you was on the cusp of saying something there.
No, I'm watching the door, so I've missed all of that,
thanks.
Unfortunately.
you be so, the bouncer.
Yeah, don't forget to unshare your screen.
Oh, thank you.
Well, I've had a couple of interesting few weeks. This week has been on catch-up week for me, but the first week I was off, I was in Dublin for this European Community meeting for the payment card industry, which is really good. But they always put on some fantastic keynote speakers. So usually it's somebody from NASA, you know. And last year there were this person from NASA was explaining how they were going to colonize the moon, and they'd already started sending equipment up there, you know, like air processing equipment and 3D printers to print buildings. So that was fascinating last year. This year they had a guy called Bob Arno, who is the world's best pickpocket apparently, and he was really good, because before his talk he was mingling with people in the exhibition area and he was picking their pockets. So he got up on the stage and he was saying, right, who's this phone, who's these glasses, who's this pen, who's this wallet, and then all got people up on stage five at a time, and then he continued to pick their pockets, take their ties off without even knowing. And you're watching, you're thinking, how do you not know he's taking your tie off, you know? But it's just unbelievable.
Now, and then I'm not an avid pickpocketer, but I believe if you touch someone in a specific place, they don't feel you going into their pocket. I think that's how they do it.
Yeah, it was absolutely fascinating. I had a catch up with him at the end of the day. Actually, I saw him sitting around having a glass of wine, so I went over and had a 20-minute chat with him. And the second day was a keynote speech by a lady called Jenny Radcliffe. And she has earned a good living, breaking into people's buildings as a social engineering thing.
Okay.
So she's from your neck of the woods. You won't be surprised to hear, Jasmine. And
you know what? I'm not even going to comment on it on the session. You just wait.
No. So, but she was absolutely engaged. Jenny Radcliffe, and she's kind of freelancer. She's kind of the people hacker, they call her, because she'll get in anywhere, you know. And she said that when she first started, she got engaged to break into footballers' houses and, you know, things like that. You know, by the footballers, and then she started breaking into buildings, and then she started
I know.
She said, and she was talking about, you know, I got challenged by these people, and so you never get in here. So I hung around outside for a day and a half. She said, the thing is that they case the joint. I mean, Bob Arno was also the case the person. So they look at you and they decide whether you're going to be, you know, worth picking the pockets of, etc. But what Jenny was saying is that they hang around outside your business for a couple of days, you know, see who's coming and going. And then they might stick a sign on the door saying, please leave this door open, or and staff do. And she said it's so easy to just manipulate people into letting her and her team through. And that was a real eye-opener, actually, and that's why I'm raising it, really. Real eye-opener on the weakest link is undoubtedly, you know, our people.
Well, going back to that first on the pickpocketer, Michael said, sounds like he stole the show. Quite literally.
It's a Dave Holmes joke.
We provide these welcome packs to new customers, and in that we have an anti-skimming card. So there's a way of stealing money from people where if you've got, you know, your bank card in your pocket, where if those contactless what do you call them?
PDQ devices? Machine.
I guess so, like a portable one. Yeah.
Yeah,
you can put in any amount and, you know, just tap it against someone's bum. They'll be offended thinking they're being assaulted, but really they're being
pleased.
or pleased, depending who you are. But yeah, I just when I first found out about that, I thought it was genius, to be honest. Not that I would want it doing to me or that I would do it to anybody else, but it's just really clever, and, you know, you've got to be on the lookout, because, you know, it's getting even more and more sophisticated.
I know. So that was my 3 or 4 days in Dublin, and then I was on holiday in Scotland for a week. But anyway, I'm back this week. I've been very busy. I did a very interesting DPIA I was looking at yesterday with Katerina, where I'm not entirely sure why we've been asked to look at it, because our client is providing a service to a third party. The third party is in a DPIA, and for some reason we've been asked to have a look at it. And it's actually quite good, because the third party is a county council. But what was interesting is that they're kind of saying, yeah, this project looks okay, because it's anonymized data, it's special category data, it's sexual orientation, it's gender, it's disability. But all the special category data is linked to a school, you know, and there's several schools in this geographic area that are taking part in this initiative, and all this data is being collected. And they're saying, well, you know, we don't have to worry about it because it's anonymized. But, you know, I'm reading through the guidance on anonymization and pseudonymization again, and I was saying to Catherine, look, it's not necessarily the case it's anonymized. You know, given a suitably small data set, you know, it might be very easy to identify the disabled child in that particular school. So you know, you just can't assume that because it's had what, you know, the personal identifiers, obvious ones, stripped out, that therefore it's free game and it's anonymized. It might not be. So that was quite interesting, just to kind of a reminder of that, and looking at this DPIA. But you know, we're saying to our client, I'm saying to our client, you know, why are you asking me to review the DPIA? Because it's your client that's doing it, you know, on you. And it's I'm not sure what, if we make any comments, I'm not sure what this county council is going to do. They'll probably say, whatever, you know, now to do with you.
Yeah, that reminds me of the case I was reading just before I came on the session. It's about a decision made by the CJEU around what constitutes personal data. So it was around vehicles. I had a quick glance at it because obviously I realized the time and jumped on here, but I'm assuming it was about registration plates, and it's saying that while, you know, on its own it might not be personal data, if there's one driver assigned to that vehicle, then it can indirectly identify the driver. And it just reminded me of, you know, what you call it, like driving styles, where you monitor driving styles and whatnot, dash cams and so on, that it can amount to personal data of an individual. So if you've got a fleet of vehicles in your organization, if you've got a dash cam that not a dash cam, a black box that monitors you know, your acceleration, your speed and so on, it's not to the vehicle, it's to that driver, and you've got to take the appropriate steps to consider that.
Yeah, no, could you put that link in, because I'm always very interested to read stuff that's talking about you know, what is personal data. That's interesting, because I was reading through, and I think we need to read more about this, the ICO's guidance on monitoring at work. Have you've seen that? That came out a few months ago, didn't it? I think August, I think, from memory. But in there, they kind of start off by saying that it's not unlawful to monitor people at work, you know, providing you comply with the data protection regimes. And then it strikes me, and I haven't read it in any great detail, so take this with a pinch of salt, and I stand to be corrected. But it strikes me that every time they give an example, it's like, say, but you can't do it like this, and you can't do it like this, and you can't do it like this. So by the time you got to the end of it, you think, well, it looks like you can't do it then. I mean, one of the things that was surprising was an example they give when they say that, you know, if you want to introduce, you know, monitoring of email traffic to try and prevent fraud, if you're a bank, you want to monitor email traffic to prevent fraud, then you ought to consider that those emails might contain special category personal data, like emails to the union reps and emails to occupational health. And all that might. I thought that we kind of were working on the basis that if it might happen, it isn't happening, and therefore you don't have to consider it. But this guidance seems to be saying, well, if it might happen, then you need to accommodate that. You need an Article 9 lawful basis for processing the possibility that you might pick up special category personal data.
Yeah, I mean, that aligns with what you were saying around anonymization, though. You know, the fact that you might be able to anonymize someone, you need to take precautionary steps in case you do.
You might be able to identify somebody. Yeah, yeah.
Goes hand in hand with that, really.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But in that case, you're doing a DPIA and you're thinking, well, you know, what's the risk of this occurring? None, therefore, we can move on. Or what's the risk of this occurring? It may happen. Therefore, we better put in place some mitigation. But it's just the way that the ICO puts this out there and says, you know, if you're doing this, then because you might pick up spectrographic data, then, you know, it's not, you can't do the monitoring without all those safeguards in place. And I just thought that was quite a bold stance to take when in other cases, I'm pretty sure their guidance say, you know, if it might happen, you don't have to worry about it. Like CCTV, you might get somebody.
Yeah, just thinking about that, Phil, would your employee not be aware of that sort of data anyway, in terms of like special category data?
Well, they're saying that you have to obviously make people aware, and it's, you know, transparency and lawfulness in the guidelines are saying these are considerations you have to do. But it's just that specific example and the fact that, you know, because the monitoring of all email traffic could detect special category data such as email sent to union representatives or to occupational health personnel, it's not you need to identify a lawful basis for the special category data, despite it, you know, not happening. Well, you know, what if somebody emailed criminal conviction data? You know, well, they might not, but it just seemed very
I think odd. with those hand in hand goes the fact that it's on a large scale for mandatory DPIA. So, you know, while it could be best practice to do a DPIA if you're processing criminal offence data or special category data in that way, that would probably seem overkill, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, again, all the way through this guidance saying, you know, you have to be able to justify, it has to be proportionate. And it basically says, you know, blanket monitoring isn't proportionate if there's another way of doing it, which may be more costly or maybe less effective. I need to read the whole guidance through, really, but I don't know if everybody else has read it that's on here, but I think it's... I think it'd be interesting to read and see what stamps they take.
I think, I don't know if it was you that picked this up, Joe, that the ICO have got a consultation for fines that closes in a fortnight. I thought that was very interesting.
That was fair, I think.
No, it was. Oh. Yeah, and I started that. I kind of clicked on, I want to submit my opinion. And then I just got bogged down in questions. I thought, oh, God, blimey, this is... I need to put like an hour aside to fill this in, really, and I've read a load of stuff. So I've paused.
Sounds like they're doing it on purpose to get people not to give their thoughts on the fines.
Maybe, but if you want to give your opinion on the fines regime, then the consultation closes on the 27th of November.
Can you add a comment for me, please? And wherever it asks you.
No, you add your own.
Say, my employee, mate, Joe Kirk, says, pull your finger out. And that's putting it lightly.
Maybe. Now, the big news of the week, I don't really think the big news, I think the King's speech was interesting, wasn't it? Which happened earlier in the week for a couple of reasons. And all this AI summit that happened.
Yeah.
I think with the King's, I don't know if you saw the King's speech, but I mean, or saw any bits relating to it, but in there, obviously, the King's speech is to introduce a new parliament and the parliamentary objectives. And, you know, one of the objectives is to try and get this DPDI, the Data Protection and Digital Information Bill, through parliament. Now, I believe we have to have a general election before the 28th of January 2025. So they've got a year to try and get it through, and it's partway through. But they're renaming it, aren't they, the DPDI. So it was DPDI, then it became DPADI2. And now it's going back to DPDI. And I think I can see a lot of confusion with old posts and things. I don't know whether it's progressed to DPDI3.
I think that's just because it's a new term. Is that what they call it? Would you call it a term of parliament?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that's why, because it's in a separate term to the other two, it can go back to just its original name. So there's no need for the number two. I don't think anything in there has actually changed. No need
for it. But when you start searching for it, you're going to get, I think, spurious references.
Where it's at now, it's in the House of Commons, isn't it, currently? Is there another reporting stage, is there? And then there's...
Yeah.
And it has to go through the House of Lords. And there's three sections in there, isn't it, that it has to go through before attaining royal consent.
Yeah.
So there's still a bit of way to go.
Yeah, so...
It'll be close.
What did you say, Jazz?
Do you think it'll be approved in time before a new parliament come in?
I think it depends what happens in the world and in the UK, you know, that to return to priorities. But there's quite a bit. There's 21 piece of legislation I think they're trying to push through. I read this, which I'm kind of why I'm raising. I read this really good review of the Data Protection disinformation bill from Clifford Chance. So I've put a link in there, and it's quite good the way it breaks it down, and it starts talking about, you know, key changes and an analysis of those key changes. So I've put that link in there if you want to kind of have a good summary. It's only fifteen pages long, but it is a really good review. It breaks it down, you know, about records posting activities and DPIAs and international transfers. And everything else that we ought to, you know, DPOs that we ought to be aware of. So I put that link there. I don't know whether it will get through or not. I mean, one of the positives is the increase of the PECA fines, isn't it, from $500,000 up to GDPR level.
Yeah, I think the thing with PECA fines, though, obviously that's an issue. And I think it's something that the ICO does focus on. If you look at the enforcement page on the website, a lot of the fines go to, you know, nuisance calls and direct marketing. I think there needs to be more of a focus on the rest of data protection compliance, because, you know, that's where I think, Joe, you've seen loads of complaints online, haven't you, about ICO enforcement, and it doesn't really seem to be directing the biggest issues in terms of developing a culture of data protection across all organisations.
Is there a reason why the ICO struggles to issue fines that is in breach of the UK GDPR? Because it seems to be quite easy to do things on PECA, but is it? I don't really know. This is, I guess, a question to you, Phil. Is it harder for the ICO to issue fines under the UK GDPR as opposed to PECA?
Well, I think that everyone's compliant, and therefore there's very few instances where there's a requirement to issue a fine.
If that was true, we would not have a job, Phil.
The news recently says otherwise as well, with the amount of reprimands that are being handed out. There was another one, wasn't there, to an NHS trust recently. Not sure if you've seen that.
I think briefly.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, and I think it's easier for them to issue fines under the PECA, and maybe some of these investigations have been going on for a long time. We don't know, do we? And maybe there is a ton of investigations currently ongoing in relation to GDPR non-compliance or Data Protection Act non-compliance. So we don't know that aspect.
While you're on the topic of investigations, did you see that the EasyJet hack investigation has been abandoned because of limited resources? This was a breach going back in 2020. Senior data protection specialist John Baines, featured in a Daily Telegraph article, stating that the ICO seems to have lost its appetite for issuing fines in the last year or so. In many cases, fines have been replaced by reprimands, which amount to little more than a slight rap on the knuckles. But here it sounds like there will be no findings made at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that they've been challenged, haven't they? So they got the AI ClearWatch overturned, that fine. So I think it is probably harder for them to make them stick. So maybe they're thinking, what's the point if we're going to get challenged by, you know, corporate lawyers who have got potentially more resources than ICO has? So, you know, maybe that's a consideration. I was also interested. There was a High Court judgment about the Court of Appeal judgment, which basically, let me just find my notes on it. A guy complained to the ICO about, I think it was a bank that had delisted his account and referred him to the Serious Fraud Squad because there was a £270,000 transfer on his account. He raised a subject tax request. I can't find my notes, so it's sort of from my very hazy memory. He raised a subject tax request, and the bank, name escapes me, went back with some information but excluded all the stuff relating to the serious fraud allegation. He challenged it again, didn't get anywhere with it, went to the ICO. They found in favour of the controller. He took it to the High Court. They said that they thought it was all dealt with properly, and they went to the Court of Appeal, which is, you know, obviously a higher level of court, and they found in favour of the ICO as well. And they looked at, you know, the obligation of the ICO in these investigations and found that they don't have to investigate thoroughly all of these complaints or incidents. They have to just kind of do what they think is necessary, entirely in their discretion. Now, the message I took out of that was, you know, if I think I've found this in the past person myself, if you build yourself a defensible position and you've got, you know, it looks like you've done the right thing, you look like you're compliant, then the ICO is more likely to find in your favor than against you. Yeah, and I found that with SARS and everything. So there's probably a whole load of things, Joe, in the mix here that's you know, eroding the appetite for issuing fines.
Just touching on what you said about, you know, you kind of anticipate that there might be lawyers out there or courts out there that have bigger resources than the ICO. So, you know, would they think, what's the point in issuing fines when they're just going to get turned over? But I feel like there's a bit of a vicious cycle here that the ICO has no appetite to enforce fines due to them getting turned over. So then organisations are less likely to enforce the law. Therefore, the ICO are going to, you know, find more issues with people who aren't complying with the law. And nothing's ever going to improve. It's just a constant vicious cycle. So I guess I don't know whether the ICO needs to be given more resources. I wasn't actually aware until me and Jasmine had a discussion earlier this morning of how the ICO were funded. And I think Jasmine said that 90% of their funding comes from the data protection fee that organisations have to pay yearly, which, you know, it's not a great amount of money, is it? So, you know, these fines that they're issuing out for millions of pounds, where does that all go? Does it just go straight to the government's back pocket?
Not quite the back pocket, but I mean...
Well, no, but, yeah. But, you know, surely the ICO should be given a percentage of that to then, you know, use it for their own advantage in terms of being able to have more resource to issue these fines. And obviously, if they start issuing these fines, then organisations may actually start to implement procedures and processes in place to ensure that they comply with the law. And then obviously there'll be no need for the additional resource because they won't be going out and conducting all these investigations because more organisations are starting to become more compliant.
It would be interesting if they kept the money, you know, they would then be allegedly motivated to you know, to chase people and issue fines. But I mean, you know, that's right. It was Wise Payments. Quite right. Thank you for that. Is it then a conflict of interests? Don't know.
Well, I'm not saying all of it, just a percentage. It might get them off the backside though and get them moving and starting to carry out, you know, full investigations.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that in the Spanish DPA, I mean, I think, you know, arguably they should keep the money. They're all driving around in Bentleys, if that had any sense.
Yeah, I mean, there's the appeal process, isn't there, to combat that conflict of interest potentially if they're overfining people. But I think it'd be really positive in giving the ICO a bit more of a backbone and also the resources to actually fulfil the requirements, I think.
I find it very disappointing. I've worked in this kind of role for like 20 years, and you know, we're still really, we're a little bit further on, but most organisations don't give a monkeys about, you know, most commercial organisations particularly don't give a monkeys about, you know, data protection, you know, management compliance. And you know, I don't know if you've got a slightly different opinion, Joe, having, But you know, I think there's not enough respect for it yet in business. I think it will come, but not if the law gets watered down, and not if the regulator isn't capable of or willing to, you know, push regulatory action.
But that's what's happening though, isn't it? You know, the law is getting watered down with this new bill, and the ICO don't have any sort of appetite to go out and find these organisations. So I just think we're kind of just going backwards as opposed to going forwards at this current moment in time. I don't know if you agree.
I think there's a danger of us going backwards.
Yeah, because I think the biggest danger of this bill, or from what I understood when I read upon it earlier in the year, was that, you know, it kind of puts our adequacy decision with the EU at risk, which obviously would not be beneficial for us at all. So if the bill goes through, we do lose our adequacy. Are we then able to backtrack and reinstate the UK GDPR? Or
Governments can do what they want, I suppose, given the mandate. But interesting times. Now, David is saying, is anybody going to the IAP conference next week? Where is it? I don't know. I'm just trying to find where it is online, but I can't actually see where it is.
It's in Brussels, Phil.
Oh, in Brussels, right? Okay, are you going?
I am.
All right, I'm afraid I'm not going. So is it a couple of days, is it? What's the format?
So the format is 2 days. I've done it, well, there is one in the UK as well. I think the European one is better. There's one in London in March. The IAP events tend to be very good. they're driven from a privacy perspective, in my opinion. There's not as much of a vendor drive. There's some vendors there, but everything's vetted before it's presented, so it's pretty good.
It's
really good. They also do, there's the opportunity to do some of the IAP trainings or some of the other IAP stuff. So I write some of the questions for some of the examinations for IAP at times. So I'm going out there early, actually. So I've got a few days there, but I'm looking at they're doing the first set of AI trainings and examinations, which are going to be interesting. So AI governance, which is something where, as an organization, really interested in making sure we understand as much as possible. So to support my area, I'm out there looking at that to see if I can expand my knowledge. So
very good.
Lucky. So I was just wondering if anybody else was there. There's a thumbs up. So if somebody is, I mean,
hopefully there are people that you'll be able to hook up with out there. Yeah, they usually have good speakers, don't they? I mean, I've been to I think PDP used to have, I don't know if they still do, used to have a conference. They had some fantastic speakers.
So the keynote last year was our favourite Austrian data privacist, I would suggest.
Oh, right. Okay, you're right.
And I would suggest he didn't come across as well as he thought he would. He's very, in my personal opinion, he was very smug, very...
I've heard that before.
Holier than thou. We're doing this as a service, sat there as the keynote, most privileged person there. I don't quite buy into all of it. And, you know, you're doing this on yourselves and, you know, all that kind of thing. So, it was interesting. But, I don't know who's doing the keynote this time, to be fair. But, it's a good session. I was just wondering if anybody's out there. I do actually need to drop off the call, so I wasn't expecting to talk today, but I'll be out there. It's really good. If you can't,
to hijack
I get some of the businesses have different challenges, so maybe not travel to Brussels isn't for all of us, but the London session's pretty good if you can't quite manage Brussels, and we'll be more focused on sort of UK legislation, so that's pretty good. This isn't very a good sales pitch for IAP by any stretch.
Sounds like we'll have to go,
but they are quite good. But,
anyway. Let's get some tickets organised. Well, have a good time out there, and if anybody else is going, then look David up and have a chat.
That's exactly what I was posting it for. If anybody's out there, I think there's an app they use. So if you post your name to the app as you're going around, you can meet up with people. So more than happy if anybody wants to meet up.
Okay. Very good. Yep. Thank you very much for that. Thank you very much.
No problem.
That.
Thanks, David.
Enjoy the radio show.
Thank you. Now, talking about AI, there was obviously the AI summit. There's a couple of other things in the King's speech as well as the DPDI bill. There's something about autonomous vehicles, and again, the impact of that is like connected. There's also this connected products legislation comes into effect in April, which I'd forgotten that existed. Actually, that's all connected products. And then there was facial recognition as well, wasn't there? Pressing police services to use facial recognition. But there was a lot this week just gone in AI, wasn't there, in terms of the Bletchley Park Summit and the European, the American announcements and the OECD, was it OECD? The European Economic Development Guidelines. I just wondered, again, there's a lot of talk about it and it's moving at a massive pace. I just wonder if it's all talk, it's all right signing up, 28 countries signing up to this Bletchley Park thing, but what's that actually going to do in practice?
I think it's very progressive, though, especially when you look at the list of countries that have signed up. But as you say, the way they gel is yet to be determined. But we touched on that a little bit last week, to be fair.
No, did you write? Sorry.
Yeah, no, it's all right. I was wondering, though, if you've managed to have any time to look further into the Clearview AI case. We tried to discuss it last week and came to some sort of conclusion, but even still, I think we were stuck on the fact that Clearview AI are a private company. How are they caught by this exemption, essentially? I don't know if you can provide any further insight.
Not off the top of my head. I did look at it a few weeks ago before I went away, and I was a bit surprised with the... I can't remember who was on the session, but it's a bit surprised with the the judgment that that Clearview AI fell outside of the scope of the UK GDPR. Mm. And I can't remember the detail of it. You have to remind me the detail of why the course. But I mean, it was well documented in the court papers, wasn't it? Which are in our notes from episode 144, probably, which is probably the last one I was on, or 145. Yeah. So I'd have to dig those back out and have a look. But I was equally surprised by the judgment. I thought it's a bit... Well, not what I expected.
Yeah, I think I got the impression that they were exempt because of who they were disclosing the data to was to law enforcements that were outside of
governments.
The UK.
Yeah, that's right. It was governments,
but
yeah.
What me and Jasmine couldn't quite wrap our heads around was, but they're collecting, scraping data from UK citizens and data subjects. So why is the scraping of the data not caught by the GDPR?
Mm. Yeah, and I'd have to reread it, Joe, but I was of the same opinion. We'll talk about it next week then, because I was of the same opinion as you. You know, I can't remember the detail of it, but it was the because they were selling it to governments was the get out, wasn't it? But
yeah, Steph's actually just popped something in the chat that relates to it, I believe. I don't
know. Oh, good. Yeah, Amber Hawk's good stuff as well, actually, so that'll be interesting to read.
Yeah, so we're not the only ones that were surprised to see it was quashed.
Yeah, Steph, do you have an opinion on that at all? Sorry to put you on the spot and don't feel like you have to unmute or anything.
He's not really sorry.
I'm surprised. I think the Amber Hawk thing is quite an interesting read. I think I always get confused with lawyers. Sometimes lawyers say one thing and I think, well, that's not quite right. But isn't there the old phrase that if you can't argue on the facts, you argue on the law, and if you can't argue on the law, you argue on the facts? And I think it's one of these. There's a
I'll have to read through it. I honestly can't remember the detail, but when I read it through and I went to the judgment, because I was so interested to find out, well, why have they made, you know, what's the justification, what's the background, what's the thinking, because the judgments are really well articulated. But I got to the end and I thought,
Wait, it says here in the link that Steph shared, it says that the decision concluded, paragraph 157, if anyone's got the thing in front of them, that the UK GDPR can apply where the monitoring of behaviour is carried out by a third party rather than the data controller. However, this processing is outside the material scope of the regulation as provided for in Article 2 of the GDPR. It is not relevant processing for the purposes of Article 3 of the UK GDPR as defined in Article 3.2a, thereby removing the processing from the scope of the UK. That's not very clear. I'm not sure
I agree with it. I mean, again, I don't want to kind of put myself out there wrongly, but I thought this relevant processing was all about the Brexit exit from the European Union, rather than this reads that, you know, relevant processing is something more than I think it is, but I have to re-look at it. I thought it was all down to the fact that, you know, the data was shared with governments and governments, and it was Saudi Arabia, it was India, it was America. Governments can't be held to be within the jurisdiction of the UK GDPR. I think that was the essence of it from my very hazy memory. And maybe that's got some merit. But maybe Clearview AI shouldn't be doing that activity. You know, maybe they, you know.
It's Shane's put in the chat. So the argument put forward by Amber Hawk was that the data was not being controlled by a foreign government, but by federal police forces. So in that sense, would that mean that Clearview AI are the data processor? Because that would make perfect sense to me, but I don't think that's the case. That's where my confusion comes.
I think they were a controller, weren't they? I mean, their decision to buy to create that data set and then try and sell it. So they can't possibly be a processor. They must be acting on their own volition.
There might be a joint controller, I guess. If they're
well, there might be a processor once someone starts using it. They might be updating or maintaining or hosting that data for somebody. But initially, you know, they are definitely, I would have thought, a controller of that data, because they're obtaining it and then trying to commercialize it. Mm.
Yeah,
anyway, so
I
can't shed any light or make any serious conversation about it, because it's evaporated from my
memory. You on the spot there, to be fair.
But you like doing that to people, I've noticed that.
Yeah, just don't do it to me. In similar fashion, so I was reading, well, you mentioned earlier about police use of facial recognition across the UK, And there is reference in this article about South Wales Police and London's Metropolitan Police using or having used facial recognition for some time now. So there are two types of facial recognition. There's live and then there's retrospective. And this article I was reading, it gives examples of live facial recognition or times when it's been used. One of them being deployed by the Met, in which nearly 250,000 people's faces were scanned when they walked past this camera or cameras. I think that was at a game at Arsenal. It can't be, that's too many people. But either way, another of these was 700,000 faces where they were scanned and two people were arrested. It just got me thinking, is this proportionate?
Well, exactly the point, isn't it? That's exactly the point. You know, to scan three quarters of a million people to find two arrests, you know, is that proportionate? Then we're talking about monitoring behaviour of employees a minute ago, you know, and the ICO is saying, well, that's not proportionate. You know, well, you know, I get it's different what purposes, and maybe law enforcement purposes is a much more serious concern than, you know, stops. Well, in the example they give, is anti-fraud work in a bank. I mean, sure, that's just as important in a different way, but it's very important, isn't it?
I think on top of that as well, so if you're scanning 700,000 faces, are you collecting personal data of all of those people, or is it only those that you've got, you know, a watch list of that records might be matched against?
According to what I've read, again, it's all what people have written and opinions, but when you're doing live face recognition, the data just passes through the cameras, isn't stored. So they must have a data set of people that they're of interest to them. Mm. And then any matches then get flagged up and alerted. But I don't think the live face recognition stores the data and adds to the database, national database of faces. But again, when you read this article you're referring to, you know, some of the purposes for processing is not to identify potential criminals or terrorist suspects. It's just stop oil protesters and protesters. Okay, is that right? Is that fair in this kind of society to, you know, inhibit people's right to protest? Seems, again, not sure about this whole notion of proportionality in those circumstances.
Yeah, that's a really good point.
I mean, for facial recognition breach of privacy, I mean, what you know, everyone's concerned about it being a breach of people, someone's right, Article 8 Human Rights Convention to right to privacy, you know, so that's the underpinning issue with it, isn't it? But the government pushes police forces to do more.
Yeah, no. And even before, you know, they've got all of the ducks in a row in terms of data protection compliance, both of them, police forces, have been found to not comply with certain requirements, whether it's the DPIA, privacy information, or I'm not sure anything else. But, you know, there's been various examples of it and they're already pushing for it. It's just a concern. It doesn't instill trust at all.
No. Trust is all too low with police forces. But that mean that, again, you're seeing this week that the ICO has said that they're going to kind of a preliminary enforcement notice to Snap for the use of an AI chatbot without doing an adequate data protection impact assessment. Again, it just seems a lot of mixed messages here. You know, why are Snap getting hold over the coals for putting an AI chatbot into their platform and not doing a thorough DPIA? And maybe the police have done a thorough DPIA, but I think that's what happened with South Wales Police in the past, wasn't it? They hadn't, and they were told to stop. But just a lot of double standards and mixed messages, I think.
Dylan's put an article in the chat from Sky News so about racial bias in AI. So officers were questioned whether a father in watch theft probe after he was wrongly identified by facial recognition technology. This reminds me of a thought I had when I was reading that article. So imagine, right, this is me going off on a tangent here, so just be prepared. But imagine you're on the run. You know, have you ever seen the film show Hunted, where they act as if they're on the run and they try not to get caught, and, you know, they've got the top secret service after them or whatnot. If you were to walk past the facial recognition camera, if you pulled a really distorted face or stupid face, would you be picked up by it? You know, how how sophisticated is this technology, or could you just pretend? To be fair, I was looking at myself, seeing if I could alter my face a little bit, look like I was having a stroke, but I don't know if I'd be picked up by that or not.
I think it would focus on is blemish is the right word on a face. So, you know, if you've got like a mole on your cheek, or you know, like your nose, I think it would do that, wouldn't it? It'd scan the shape of your nose, I think, and then match it.
What about if you flare your nostrils and then like put your jaws to the side a little bit? I'm not going to do it on this. I'm not going to embarrass myself.
Oh, go on. Let's get a screenshot. Go on.
So anyway, but it is a good point. You know what? How good is this technology even?
I don't know. Have you ever seen there was a really good TV program called The Young Offenders? It was two young Irish criminals. Yeah, yes, bike thieves. Anyway, one of them they end up getting a Billy Murphy mask. Billy Murphy's a local bully to start with, and they get Billy Murphy mask and they wear this Billy Murphy mask whenever they're stealing bikes, and the police go and arrest Billy Murphy. And then find he's actually growing cannabis, which is when he goes to prison.
Oh, I think Jeremy Clarkson did that on an episode of Top Gear. He was speeding and he held a mask of, I can't remember who it was, but he held a mask of someone he wasn't particularly fond of when he got caught speeding. So it wasn't
would it work?
I don't know. I've got no idea. But
Jasmine,
I mean, it's worth a shot, isn't it?
Detail to go and try it out.
And, on official data protection people. Research.
Do you want to chime in, Andrew?
Yeah, just to add to it, like the facial recognition software is something that's been in place for quite some time. It's exactly the same software that's used when you come into border control. So when you put your passport in, it will utilize your biometrics within your passport to identify that you're the person using it. So it will look at a number of measures across someone's face. So it won't just pick out a couple of little things. It will take a lot of information that's there. Mm. When the police are using it, it is based on information held within. There's a database called LiveScan, or there's a system called LiveScan. When anybody goes into a custody facility and is arrested for an offence, they are put onto LiveScan. And then that keeps a record of that individual at that point in time. That is potentially what they're using in the database to scan people against, especially for those people that are wanted. I know where people, and I understand that's a lot of people to be scanned through to get to people. But if it's utilised in the right circumstance, I think it could be something that is proportionate. But again, what is that right circumstance? Because it's something that kind of, you know, you can't just stick it everywhere, if you know what I mean.
It feels like a slippery slope with that as well.
Yeah.
You know, border control, you can't argue that argument, but...
Do people have an option to get scanned when they go into custody suites?
Sorry?
Do people have an option? You know, no. Do you mind if we live scan you, or is it, right, go and stand there, we're going to live scan you?
No, when people have been arrested, generally it's done one when they come in to scan to make sure they've given the right details over, so you can ascertain who they are. If they're already known in the system, that will come back and say they are who they say they are. Or in certain offences, it will be kept on record. Sometimes somebody can come in, they'll be scanned. That matter might be not, you know, the action might not be taken any further. That will be retained for a period. But you don't really get a choice, because they're part of that booking in process, part of that dealing with that individual. But then there have been instances, for example, where they've taken a DNA sample. It's not required any further. It can be disposed of, but obviously there's certain rules behind it, way above what I would understand. But I just know a little bit about what they do on that, using. They're not just using all databases. They're using the database that they've got, which has got either people that have been arrested or charged with offences or known offenders. But in a targeted way, it could be very useful. But is it right to be putting it at something like a concert? Because I think one of the ones that the South Wales used it at was a Beyonce concert.
It was,
I suppose with anything.
After Ariana Grande, you know, that they possibly think maybe this is, they might have had intelligence and thought there's a potential terror threat here. But, you know, who knows? I mean, anything that makes us safe is obviously good. you know, but there are, should it become normalized? Should it become the way that policing is carried out, you know, all the time? Should speed cameras capture your face as well? You know,
I don't think it needs to capture your face, does it, if you're getting caught speeding?
Not always. But, it will depend on the type of camera that's taken that image.
It can. There's talk of installing speed cameras, or not even speed cameras, but cameras on motorways that can check whether you're on your phone, if you've got your seatbelt on, if you're eating a burger in one hand, steering with your knees. You know, I've not seen that implemented anywhere yet. I just know that it has been trialled, but I'm not sure what the next steps are really.
I think it's been trialled by Devon and Cornwall mobile phone at the moment. Yeah. And that's based around something to do with signals and AI, understanding what it's taking an image of. I don't know how successful that's been, but I know in America that they've seen some good success with it, and that's why it's been trialled over here. I think a couple of other forces have taken that vehicle over, but it all comes down to what's proportionate in the circumstance. And I think, you know, I think in one way it's good to see people trying to utilise technology to be a bit smarter around what they're doing. But it's like, yeah, it comes down to like, when is it suitable to use it? When should we use it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
If there's an officer in that situation, you know, a police officer would stop a motorist who was clearly out of control. So, I suppose, why is there a problem for technology to do that job, apart from the fact that technology does it on a massive scale, you know, massively quickly? But it'll discount most lawfully, you know, most people driving lawfully, and just pinpoint on those that aren't, I guess. And I think it's an interesting point Cara makes. You know, there's a balance between protecting the public from, you know, people who are driving dangerously, and, you know, who are arguably fewer than those who are not driving dangerously, given the number of incidents and accidents, given in proportion to the number of journeys made. But that's all in the mix, isn't it? That's what keeps us all thinking this stuff through, talking about it.
Yeah, I think if it scans someone and it's flagged not a match to someone in the database, and it's not, you know, it's not retained, then I don't really see it as too much of an issue. Because obviously that's 750,000 people that were scanned for the two arrests. I imagine only the two people that were arrested were the ones that would have been retained the data. So then the other.
Well, you say that, Joe, until you go to you happen to be walking past a protest, a political protest, where facial recognition is used, and you get your image taken, and somebody decides that actually you're an obnoxious protester, and therefore you're on the database, or you get arrested for something, and then there's grounds it's mistaken identity, and you get released, no charges, nothing, but your database, your mug is in LiveScan, then it might become an issue for you.
Yeah, there's that concern of misuse of police powers as well, in terms of, you know, if it was to be misused in this sense of adding people to databases and whatnot. I don't know whether it's power mad, individual police officers, not the main, but it does happen. So.
But it's here. It's,
the same people. The genie is out, aren't
they? Yeah, it comes down to that trust, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Trust.
And I don't think the UK public does have that trust with the police force across the country.
No.
On another note, totally unrelated, this is my weekly pop at the ICO. So I don't know if you saw that Equifax had a fine from the Financial Conduct Authority, the 11 million quid or something. Mm-hmm. And everyone's referring back to the ICO fine in 2018, when I thought, I can't remember what that was about. So the Financial Conduct Authority, one of the things is kind of suppliers and no contracts. And I thought, right, okay, well, I want to have a look at the ICO's monetary penalty notice to see, you know, I would just want to review it again. It's not there. All the historical monetary penalty notices have gone. You cannot find it. I mean, how ridiculous is that? You know, I think it's outrageous that they've got such a wealth of information for privacy practitioners to use, yet it's not available. I think it's terrible. I think they provide a really poor service to privacy practitioners in that regard. You know, the guidance is often hard to find and hard to read and hard to understand and hard to know what's changed and what's updated. And then why isn't there a comprehensive database of all monetary penalty notices? Because we might want to refer back to them. anyway, it's not there.
And you're
I think
not happy
I actually
about
do
it.
Have. No, I do. I think I do actually have a PDF of that because I do went through a phase of every month stripping out all the and PDFing and putting them in our technical library.
Well, but, you'll have to keep that updated, and you can be the UK's database of monetary penalty notices moving maybe. Forward. If anyone wants to know who the ICO have fined and why they've done it, come to Phil Bryan.
Historically, yeah.
Just to go back to our previous conversation, Steph said, Joe, you must have experience of just in case or surely someone in data protection. I don't think we've touched on it today, actually. I read that the ICO and European Data Protection Board have signed a memorandum of understanding.
Oi, that's mine, you bugger.
Well, you didn't say it, and there's 7 minutes left, so I'm stealing.
Well, I was going to say that it was for you, this, Phil, because, Phil, you always say on here that you look at European data protection guidance and say it would be silly not to consider it, although we're no longer part of the EU. You know, it is very similar laws. And as Jasmine said,
you didn't get much of a chance to say, did you?
No, the ICO and the European Data Protection Supervisor has signed a memorandum of understanding, and it's set out to continue to share experiences and best practices. Corporate on specific projects of interest cooperate, share information or intelligence to support regulatory work and then promote dialogue among data protection authorities and other digital regulators.
Yeah, that confirms, you know, the way we've been working since Brexit, really, doesn't it? And it's a sensible approach.
Yeah. That's I think, you know, I think that the judgments, you know, are, and the guidance are all relevant at the moment. Is still very similar law, if not identical law, isn't it? So it just, again, I just like reading the rationale behind the decision making processes. Some things are diverging a little bit, but, you know, a lot of the time it's worthwhile looking at what the European supervisory authorities are doing, you know, and how they're judging, ruling on things. And to that end, I looked at, when I was looking at monitoring the monitoring guidance from the ICO, I looked at German, Austrian, Spanish, and Irish. And in Austria and in Spain, they say that you're not allowed to do monitoring of employees, you know, social media posts. Actually, this is social media posts, checking employee social media posts. We need to come onto this on another session, probably, actually. But in most of the jurisdictions, they said you probably can do it as long as you do it in a proportionate way. But again, there's that difference of opinion, isn't there, which is you interesting to know.
Yeah. I don't think employees should outright go out of their way to monitor what people are posting on their social media, because it is, you know, what they're doing in their own, it's their own personal stuff. But I think if something gets raised to an organization about something that an employee's posted, you know, if it was a racial abuse or something along those lines, then I'd, you know, then obviously that will open up things for the employer to justify why they go and have a look at the socials. But I don't think, say, DPP, for example, should start going on to Jasmine's Instagram page and finding things that they might not like, because, you know, that was kind of their own fault for going on there in the first place.
No, I think it's more, you know, it's often like, you know, Jasmine's Bungdasiki, not, you know, not that you ever would, of course, Jasmine, to go to a Beyonce concert just to try out this facial recognition funny face thing, somebody highlights that, oh, I saw Jazz at that concert, you know, it looked like Jazz, but it might not have been Jazz because of the distorted features and everything. Well, you know, then employers then might go onto the social media post to verify and corroborate, you know, those kind of accusations. Or an employee, you know, is allegedly making defamatory comments or negative comments about the employer, you know, then the employer might want to go and have a look at them. So there probably are scenarios where it's justified. But anyway, it's just, again, interesting, the differences of opinion between the different super authorities. And, you know, back to your point that, you know, there's the guidance is usually, you know, worth reading, but not necessarily applicable, despite there being an MOU in place now.
I think with that, you know, it's one of those where you've just got to let people know that you might do that in certain instances beforehand. It's like, you know, not monitor employees on CCTV, but you might potentially use CCTV if someone's been caught sleeping round the back, you know.
Right.
That that difference in opinion is, again, reminds me of, you know, supervisory authorities' approach to cookie consent and banners. It's, you know, so from one supervisory authority where it might be okay to not have a reject all button on the banner and the first layer of information, compared to where it's necessary under other supervisory authorities. And I think that difference in approaches is really interesting, because I don't agree that it shouldn't be on the first layer.
I don't agree at all, and I could not wrap my head around why you wouldn't have that on there, because not having a reject all button to me is not freely given. But then if you have the text saying you know, more options here to go and have a look at you know, the privacy the cookie policy, and then you can reject all again. I think that's nudging people towards accept all, because people on websites, they just, let's be honest, you're not going to click see more to then reject all. I reject all when it's there, but if it's not there, I'm just going to press accept all, just because I want to get on that website and get off as quick as I can. You know, there might be some instances where people would, you know, are different to me, but that's my personal opinion, and not having that on there is pushing me towards pressing the accept all.
Yeah,
in my opinion.
I read that the German data protection authorities don't require a reject all button in the first layer. If the consent button is not displayed in the first layer, or the user can interact with the website without having to interact with the cookie consent banner. But that, I don't trust that, because there's people that are aware of it and that look for it. I'm sure you'll have noticed that if you go onto a website and even where you clicked accept all, if you could, if it does have reject all and you click that, the page refreshes as if it was already collecting cookies, and now it's gone to a mode where it doesn't collect cookies. Well, that's my understanding of it anyway, or suspicions. But yeah,
I found most interesting about that is the kind of this view that Article 7 requires that withdrawing consent must be as easy as providing consent, but it doesn't say that declining consent must be as easy as consenting. So withdrawing consent and declining consent are just two distinctly different actions. So that again, I found that quite interesting, the way that distinction's made. There's a point here that the Keeping Children Safe in Education legislation requires background checks, and arguably, I don't know if it requires ongoing checks. That might require some kind of looking at social media activities of prospective employees. I'm just looking at the National Archives as well. Thank you for that link. I'll have a look. I don't know if the hopefully the ICO's monetary penalty notices will make it to the National Archives, but maybe there is. There's no obvious announcement there to say, you know, we've taken this down, go and have a look here. But anyway.
Yeah, that's a good point. Have to do some digging.
dig, get me spade out.
Yeah. Well, with that being said, it is the end of the session. Thank you both for a really good session. I've really enjoyed this one, and I hope everybody else has as well. We will be back next week. I believe it's accountability part two, if I'm correct.
It is. Yeah. We'll have catch Phil up on that, what we spoke about and what's left to discuss.
Although I'm sure he listened in last week.
I'm afraid I didn't. But I could listen back.
No connection in Scotland.
Now I can listen back over it.
Sure. But yeah, have a great weekend and rest of next week in the meantime. And thank you for joining.